You're listening to The Daily Digestionalist with Matthew Heidmark at RadioArian.com.
This is your host of The Daily Traditionalist, Matthew Heimbach, and I'm here today. I'm a little dog tired because I stayed up all night watching the results, but I can say happily, rule Britannia, Brexit has passed, the largest victory for nationalists since 1933 in Germany. The United Nations of the European Union, that supposedly this 27-country block of totalitarianism and globalism mandating everything from immigration to what your pillow is, has finally struck the first blow against it. The beast is wounded, the Jenga Tower has had one of its blocks removed, and it's wobbling, and now countries around Europe, the nationalists are asking for their own referendums. This could be the end of the European Union, which could mean the end of NATO and the end of the globalist experiment that has been ruining our nations and our people for the past 71 years. So I am so amazingly excited to be here. It is a great day to be a nationalist. Wading through the leftist tears on Twitter and social media, I'm going to have to get some hip waders because they are flowing on both sides of the Atlantic. Very, very exciting stuff. But this isn't just about me and how excited I am about Brexit. We're here today with Asmodor to be able to discuss what his perspective is. So Asmodor, let's start with you. How are you doing today, and how do you feel about the initial thing of Brexit coming out?
Well, I'm great. Other than being a little tired like you, I stayed up late too so that I would know what the results were before I recorded my show for this evening. And I'm very, very excited by it. This is a big deal, about as big as it gets. And if you don't think it is, then people should go look at the stuff you're talking about. To look at the way the left is reacting to this, you'd think that they voted for Day of the Rope or something.
Well, it's the beginning of the end, and everybody sees it. It's absolutely amazing because, of course, you know, the European Union, it started as a trade bloc, almost like in the United States where independent states started as we were just going to trade and have mutual defense, and then, oh, we're going to get a constitution, and then eventually we've got men in dresses in women's bathrooms, 3,000 unborn children murdered a day, and open borders. You know, it's amazing how things, once you take the bait, how quickly things fall to pieces. And the same thing happened in Europe over the past several decades. What originally was just an economic agreement has eventually become this behemoth where the majority of laws and regulations impacting Europeans from the Atlantic all the way into Eastern Europe is dependent upon Brussels, these unelected bureaucrats that are in the pockets of bankers and globalists, if they're not explicitly bankers and globalists. So this defeat, especially considering that Britain is such a huge part of the EU economy, it's absolutely huge. They lost a sixth of the economic power of the EU in one night. So it's absolutely amazing. Where do you think we're going to be going from here?
Hopefully to Texas and other states that I guess you could change the letters around a little bit. you know, that folks like the people over at Texas Nationalist Movement are always watching these things really close. They were watching the one in Scotland that was narrowly defeated, and now this one. It brings a lot of energy to secessionist movements in the United States and elsewhere, especially the United States, because, you know, the things that you just mentioned, that's basically what the United States was set up to be. It was a confederation of sovereign states that had, you know, a very limited and precise powers given to it that basically had to do with common defense, trade between the states, international trade, and foreign policy. And, you know, ever since the Civil War, nobody's been able to leave. You know, we had a petition a year or two ago that was on the YouGov, where if you get something like 100,000 or more votes, the president has to answer. And the question was, would if we wanted it, would Texas be allowed to vote in a referendum like this? And the answer was, and he got 125,000 votes or people signing the petition. And the answer was no. We would not be allowed to make this choice. So this is a big blow for self-determination, which is what we want as a people.
Well, exactly. And, you know, the thing that I see is it just goes to show, it's an example I've talked about on my show before, but it involves the UK is the example I like to give. But the difference between the IRA and the Scottish National Party. Now, of course, I'm not debating ideologies, not anything like that. I'm just talking about pure examples. That the Irish Republican movement in many ways reflects kind of what a lot of white nationalists who I think are misguided in the United States think of we're just going to get into a bare-knuckle brawl with a more powerful entity and darn the consequences, you know, versus the Scottish National Party using politics. There was no mass internment or anything like that to be able to get a referendum. There was no Scottish Bloody Sunday or anything like that. And I mean that to insult any of my British listeners or comrades, just as a pure example, that peaceful politics, and we talked about it before, really puts the system between a rock and a hard place, because as we can see, we can mobilize the masses, even the majority of the masses, for our perspective, for self-determination, for nationalism. And if we do it in a way where any repression against us would reflect badly on the system and delegitimize them further, thus strengthening our cause and our argument in the first place, they're between a rock and a hard place. And I think we as white nationalists, as white advocates, need to take this moment and really decide as a movement one of two things. Are we going to continue living in the pie-in-the-sky dream of purity? And I mean that in terms of ideological purity, where, you know, we declared, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, we're going to retake America to be all white from the East Coast to the West Coast, from sea to shining sea, everything like that, which is just not going to happen. And I think we know that. And the only way that could be accomplished is through a campaign that I would believe would be unsuccessful for many reasons, but would turn the majority of white people against us and would absolutely not achieve any of our geopolitical aims. Or can we look at what Brexit was able to achieve? They were able to mobilize British nationalists and normal, everyday British people that were tired of globalism, that were tired of not having a voice, and giving them a voice, giving them a path to channel it, to be able to fight for self-determination. So I think we in the white nationalist movement need to make a very clear choice, looking at these historical realities and the geopolitical world we're living in, where, you know, France, Marine Le Pen is now talking about a referendum for France. Geert Wilders is talking about, in his nation, having a referendum. And this is only going to continue. The EU could fall apart. And if we realize the EU is much like the United States in many, many ways, I think we as a movement really need to just come to terms with this, that model of nationalism, it doesn't mean sacrificing any of our principles. It just means using the politics and the tools available for us and realizing what strategies work. And England is probably the closest to us, even if you're not descended from Anglo-Irish stock. We're an Anglo-Saxon country culturally, linguistically, I mean, a whole bunch of other things. If it can work in the UK, it can work here. And I think it translates much better than, as much as I love the Germans in the 30s and 40s, it's much easier to translate an Anglo-Saxon phenomenon and movement and verbiage and language and presentation to part of the Anglosphere, of which we're a part of. So that's where I think we need to look more in this direction, towards asking for self-determination and then organizing, mobilizing, and fighting for it, and following the Brexit model versus the subcultural, reading the Turner Diaries too much model. I kind of want to know your thoughts on that, where how we as white nationalists can look at Brexit and what steps our movement needs to take to become politically relevant.
Well, the main way that I look at things from is, the narrative and kind of momentum we have, because, that's basically my role is just, I'm a guy who has been studying this stuff for a long time, and I talk about it on the radio. I leave a lot of the organizing stuff to other people, but this Brexit has really delivered us a huge punch of momentum. If we're going to be able, all we have to do is ride it. We have to keep it moving. And, you can see this all over the press this morning. I mean, I have an article open here on Daily Mail that says Brexit is proof that Donald Trump is going to be president. And, you know, and it's like five reasons why. And, you know, without reading anything from the article or whatever, you know, the reasons are just exactly the broad things that anybody could name, you know, nationalism, populism, and you know, it goes on through, things like that. But interestingly enough, it's got, tweets from, you know, all celebrities and writers and all. And that's what they're all saying. I mean, and they're very unhappy about it. Like Wanda Sykes, the comedian, she says, that Nigel dude is British Trump. He said a win for real people, decent people. Why didn't he just say white people, you know?
So, I would ask Mr. Farage the same question, to be honest.
Right. Yeah, but just without the implied irony.
Yeah.
But
without the snow.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you know, I'm glad to see the reaction that the losers are having to this. And, but the thing, to get back to your point about, you know, what does this mean for us? Well, one thing is it means that for nationalists in America and elsewhere outside of the UK, we get to watch as they write a blueprint, you know, a few months ahead of the cycle that we're in. And we can, you know, we can see where mistakes get made and we can see where things go right. This is going to be really, really interesting. One thing that people who have been into secessionist movements for a long time will tell you is that once you have this big win with an election, that's when you really have to get vigilant because, you know, the next thing that's going to happen, you know, once they're officially and legally out of the EU, they're going to have to start writing their own regulations and their own immigration policies and all that. And you're going to have lots of the same old people that were trying to keep them in the EU in their, you know, stirring the pot, trying to keep the non-white immigration coming in, trying to keep sending the jobs out and all like that. So the hard work for the British people really starts right now. And it's going to be interesting to see how well, I guess as we were talking about before we were on the air, UKIP, I keep wanting to call it UKIP, but I guess there's, someone else said, there's no need for UKIP now. They're already independent, but, you know, all those people who led the charge to get this thing done, you know, now the work starts.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's easy. I was reading a book on, communist revolutionaries in China, and you know it's really easy to take over a government, you know, per se. It's very hard to run one. I mean, making the trains run on time is far more difficult than the initial revolution. So I think you're totally right that now it's going to be up to the British people to really take the charge, because the same internationalists, the same capitalists, the same Jews are going to be working to subvert this process, to, you know, try and hold another referendum, or at the very least, effectively make no changes to keep the status quo, to keep pressuring people, to keep trying to scare people, to, you know, that, you know, George Soros threatened before the Brexit vote that there'd be huge implications for the British economy, which sounds to me like a threat, considering the damage he already did to the British economy a few years ago. So what I see with this is, you're right, it's the process of state building that we need to be able to have, you know, here in America too. We need to have a plan, and that doesn't mean every regulation for how big a stop sign is or what color of yellow we're going to use on the roads, on the side of it. But we do need to have a clear plan, and there need to be principles that cannot be compromised. And we need to be pragmatic. We're politicians after all. But in order to be able to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children, we need to be able to have a clear roadmap of what our objectives are and of what we're going to accomplish and what there are things like, for instance, having our, you know, if we were to secede, we would no longer have the Federal Reserve. Having the Federal Reserve control our monetary policy would have to be something that is just non-negotiable because we wouldn't truly be free. So the UK, I think, really now has to be able to see and organize, and the forces of UKIP and the Conservatives have voted this way, even some Labour areas that are just tired of the impact of globalism, need to come together to be able to secure the revolution. The revolution just isn't about raising your flag. It's about being able to keep that flag up. And they need to be sure that these forces of the EU and globalism are going to be circling like buzzards, you know, like vultures, trying to pick them off. So they need to be able to stand strong, stand united, and be able to make sure that they truly will be free. And this truly is an Independence Day. Because if they don't secure the revolution for the long term, this is just going to be a temporary setback for the EU and globalism. But if this can become a total victory, it'll begin a domino effect for the entire Western world.
Well, yeah. And, you know, it's almost a given that the internationalists that don't want this thing, that didn't want this thing to happen, are going to do everything they can, like you said, to reverse it. I haven't read the article yet, but I already saw the headline over on Drudge. Soros is selling everything he's got short in England to, or in UK, to purposely cause the stocks and the currency to go down. And, you know, the media has been screaming about it for months and months that this was going to wreck the economy. And now for months, they're going to be screaming that they were right. And the thing is, like you said, that's the UK is 1/6 of the EU economy. So it's not like this is going to be one of these divorces where the jilted partner gets angry and says, never speak to me again. The door is always going to be open to come back. And the challenge is for the British people to stay strong throughout this process and not get a, you know, become afraid when things start to get a little bit rough. But they've already shown that they are resilient enough to overcome that stuff. I mean, there wasn't a single angle that you could imagine where you make things up that could possibly happen, why you shouldn't vote for this, but they did vote for it. And that's very, very, I was surprised. I mean, even, just a day before the election, the polls were saying they were going to stay. And, you know, after the shooting of the MP Joe Cox and all, they were claiming that support for it was falling off. But I guess they were lying.
Well, and, you know, the thing that I'm also worried about, because, of course, as Boris Johnson said, you know, the Vote Remain campaign was, you know, promoting fear, which they really are. One thing I am slightly nervous about is because if you've seen with EU referendums before, like when the Irish rejected an EU referendum and they were just overridden, what I'm reading right now just put up was, could Britain face a second EU referendum already? MPs could be forced to debate staging another vote after petition tops 100,000 target within hours of Brexit result. And then it goes on, petition demands the government restage the EU referendum because it was won by less than 20% margin. And it says another vote is necessary because the turnout was below 75%. So it looks like already that, and this is the thing, we need to be able to work politically, legally, and peacefully, as long as humanly possible to be able to achieve our objectives. But it is one of the eye roll moments of democracy that can be very frustrating and make you just want to tear your hair out. Not that I have much hair, but you know what I mean. That they're actually already talking about overriding the will of the people. And if this happens, I swear the EU will either implode or Britain could go into a civil war or something. Because if this was direct democracy, David Cameron was talking about, this is an example of direct democracy. If direct democracy is just ignored and said, no, Britons, you need to do this again. You didn't do it the way we wanted. Democracy is already illegitimate, I believe, but it'll just go to prove how the system has no belief in the people or abiding by the principles it says that it stands for. We essentially live in a banana republic. So I want to get your take, Asmodor, on the thought that they've already gotten over 120,000 signatures, which means that the parliament will consider this for debate. They might be debating. Here we are, like less than a work day later, after the Brexit result has been solidified and called. Now they're talking about another referendum. So tell me what you think about this.
Well, it's ridiculous by the standards that you know, you just laid out that they're putting out there in their talking points, no election would ever be legitimate. First of all, the fact that less than 75% turned out, that's the most ridiculous canard ever. I mean, that is the percentage of people that they had turn out, you know, just being over 70 is unbelievable. You never see that kind of election turnout. Secondly, as far as the over 100,000 or 120,000, however many it is, people who are saying it. So you lose an election and you get to go on a website and sign a petition because you want another election because you didn't like the way that one went. Well, let me tell you, every time Obama got elected, you could go to a small state here in the United States and start a petition just in that state and get that many in a few hours. You know, like I say, every single thing that they have there is just a way to change the results when you don't like them. And that really is the big flaw in democracy. People think that because they're able to go pull a lever or push a button or write in somebody's name, that they actually have a say in all this stuff, but they don't. They try to weigh it down at the beginning by making it an either or thing where neither choice is any good. And then if you don't make the right choice with that, why, they'll do these things you mentioned, or maybe even just get it before a judge, you know, like they did with gay marriage in California and just tons of other things. You know, you can have millions of people vote, but if you can just get it in front of one judge, well, you know, you get your way over all those people.
Well, civil rights trump the, you know, of course, civil rights means anything. It's just the way that judicial review is a total bastardization of what a system is supposed to be. It's what we have in America. It's what makes America a tyranny. There's no reform mechanism in America because a judge can just overthrow whatever we want. I mean, now, you know, for instance, I mentioned before the Supreme Court case with affirmative action that now they've upheld that race-based preferences in college admissions and higher education is acceptable. So now the Supreme Court has ruled it's constitutional to discriminate against whites, and we've got nowhere to go with it. There's nothing we can do about it. Our government supports state-sanctioned discrimination against our people, and there's nothing we can do about it except leave, except get out of this system. The house is on fire. It's time to get out. But, I mean, the thing in the UK, I mean, what this spurs on, because we saw with the vote last night with Scotland. Scotland is just so absolutely cucked. It's just painful. William Wallace has spun so many times in his grave, we'd have an infinite supply of renewable energy just based on how ashamed he is of his people. But, you know, they want to be part of the EU. They want to join the EU. They want to be able to get as many African immigrants and Middle Eastern immigrants as they want and just destroy their country. And Sadiq Khan, you know, the new Muslim mayor of London, is talking about having London secede to become part of the EU. I mean, we're talking about the total possible breakdown of countries that have existed, well, I mean, in this case, an empire, but that have existed for centuries. And everything is coming apart at its seams, and the left is losing its mind. And, you know, it seems to me like almost like a tiger or you know, a lion or some other big animal, that when it gets wounded and feels itself dying, it just starts lashing out indiscriminately, trying to take as many things with it as it can. And it seems to me that the EU and the globalists just might be implementing that policy of just busting apart the remains of the British Empire within the United Kingdom, having regions of the UK secede from the UK. I mean, it's absolute insanity, but it just goes to show how this did not go according to their plans.
No, and the thing is, I think we're still at the point now, and will be for some time, where they think that they will be able to coerce the UK back into line, you know, put that dog back on the porch, so to speak. But once, you know, as if the British stand firm on this, once the globalists realize that they're not going to, then yeah, they'll definitely pull out all the big guns and try some scorched earth policy because they want to show the rest of the world what happens when you don't do what they say. And, you know, when you don't fall in line with the program. And unfortunately for them, it won't work as well now as it did in the 30s and 40s. You know, that's exactly why they went after Germany the way they did, was because Germany pulled themselves out of the globalist system of that day, which, you know, was the Rothschild banking system and everything else that went along with it. And so, yeah, that it's going to be really interesting. But if you want, I pulled up a couple of quotes that Anthony Kennedy gave in that affirmative action case, just to show, because you were saying how ridiculous judicial review is. You know, the Supreme Court of the United States is supposed to decide things purely on constitutional principles. And everybody knows that's the biggest joke on earth that they don't. But it's unusual to hear them in their majority decision say that they ruled on their own whims instead of on the Constitution. And that's what he basically says here. He says, a university is in large part defined by those intangible qualities which are incapable of objective measurement, but which make for greatness. So right there, we're intangible qualities which are incapable of objective measurement. In other words, BS, right?
Because diversity is our strength no matter what the data suggests.
Right.
Yeah, because diversity is our strength because diversity is our strength. That's the rationale for all of this. It just is, regardless of any objective overview. I'm glad they admitted that.
and therefore, since diversity is our strength, whether we can measure it or not, he says, considerable deference is owed to a university in defining those intangible characteristics like student body diversity that are central to its identity an educational mission, but still it remains an enduring challenge to our nation's education system to reconcile the pursuit of diversity with the constitutional promise of equal treatment and dignity. And while that may be a problem for our universities, it should not be a problem for the Supreme Court that's supposed to rule only on constitutional principles. And you're absolutely right. They have ruled that you can make decisions based on race, but only when it comes to white people.
Well, I mean, you know, feelings and things like that are far more important than the rule of law. You know, again, as many of us all like to point out, the fact that our ancestors were willing to fight a bloody revolution over a tax on tea and not getting proper representation in Parliament, in their opinion, and then our ancestors in the South were willing to secede over the fear of the coming Lincoln tyranny that was about to come over the horizon. The fact right now that we have state-sanctioned discrimination against our people, and white people today woke up and said, well, that's great. I'm so glad. Like, our universities need to be more vibrant. We need to be able to compete. We need to be able to get the best and take all the, you know, everyone in. And they're just cheering their own genocide. I mean, this system has just lashed us to the plowshares of the elites and to their shackles. And the only thing at this point when it comes to getting out of, you know, this corrupt system, the only thing we have to lose is our chains. And, you know, the Marxists say that, but it's true in this case because we are shackled not only to close to $20 trillion in private debt and almost $20 trillion in public debt. We're not only chained to demographic displacement and attacks on our culture. We're also chained to state-sponsored discrimination against our people. And if there was any reason to remain in this system as a white person, I don't know what else you need to know other than state-sponsored racial discrimination against you is a good thing. Why would you remain in a system that has agreed based on their feelings that denying your sons and daughters the ability to get a higher education, which it's got to start with education and go to jobs, and it's going to go all downhill. They did the same thing in South Africa, and eventually our reality is death and squatter camps and depression, and eventually there's going to be none of us left. I mean, that to me seems to be the roadmap.
Right. And that's why, you know, you're right to stay on the whole secession thing, because just think, if a state like Texas were able to secede, the things that we could do differently tomorrow, we could control our own border. We could set our own immigration policy. We could devise our own education policy without Obama's pen telling us what bathrooms our children can go to. And just the list goes on and on and on of the things that we could do with local control. But we're never going to get what we want out of this vast and distant bureaucracy up in Washington, D.C. It's a monster that's been out of control for a long, long time. And you can't tame a monster like that. You just have to either escape from it or kill it.
Exactly. Well, it's so exciting. As we come to the end of another week of the Daily Traditionalist, I am so happy to be able to end on such a great note. That the Hydra has had one of its heads cut off and received a wound near its heart. And now let's hope that France and the Netherlands and other countries, I was talking to one of my comrades in Golden Dawn this morning about how they want to be able to follow in, following these footsteps, that I think the spear of St. George might be launched into the heart of this Hydra very soon and finally kill the globalist beast. It's going to take a lot of hard work. It's going to take a lot of sacrifice. And the battle has just begun. It's far from over. But this is a great sign for us, a great day for the Western civilization. And now it's time to keep making some gains. So, Asmodor, thank you, as always, for being here. And last thing, do you have a 10 or 15-second final thought as we go into the weekend?
Well, just watch what they're doing in Britain really close, because we're going to be doing it here really soon.
That's the truth, and that's a great message to leave us on. So thank you again, Asmodor. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for another amazing week of the Daily Traditionalists. So excited to be with you guys, and we're going to be back on Monday to be here with another great week. So thank you guys so much. Thank you, Sven, again, for being my co-host and all the great tech work you do, and thank all of you guys. So I'll see you on the other side of the weekend. Have a blessed rest of your day, and hail victory!
Be tuned into The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heimbach at RadioArea.com.